A brain tumor diagnosis is a traumatic and life-changing event, resulting in altered priorities as part of a new normal way of life for a patient and their family. I'm Kathy Oliver, Chair and Co-Director of the International Brain Tumor Alliance. Since 2005, we've been creating a dynamic global community for brain tumor patient advocacy organizations and others involved in the field of neuro-oncology. Through our worldwide experience and expertise, we've been working to improve the well-being and quality of life for patients and their families. We advocate for the best treatments, information, and support for brain tumor patients, offering them, their families, and caregivers hope wherever they live in the world. In this series, we'll be meeting some of those working in the field of neuro-oncology, the people who support patients and their families, and those who've been told they have a brain tumor. We'll learn how brain tumors have affected all of these people, often in surprising ways. Welcome to A Brain Tumor and Me, a journey of inspiration, personal stories, and hope. In our second episode of the series, we meet Dr. Alfredo Quiñones Hinojosa, the William J. and Charles H. Mayo Professor and Chair of Neurologic Surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Dr. Q, as he's known, talks to our reporter Graham Seaman about his remarkable journey, how he was nearly killed in an accident which changed the course of his life, and about his hopes for the future of neuroscience and medicine.
Well, this for sure is going to be one story I can't wait to hear and share with you. Dr. Q, thank you so much for giving up some of your time today. I want to go back to your childhood. What was that like for you? How do you remember it?
Well, when I was young, I had a life full of exploration. That's how I would define it. I was not someone who had a lot of material things, but we did have an amazing family that stayed together despite of difficult, challenging times, being very poor, my little sister dying. My mom and my dad, they figured out a way to allow us to use our imagination to travel, you know, long distances. I was encouraged to dream. I was encouraged to never think that there was anything that I couldn't do. Despite of the fact that we were poor, my mom and dad, they figure out the way to encourage that spirit of adventure. And same thing with my grandparents. So we had a tight-knit family community. We live in the middle of nowhere, by the way. We didn't have anything. There was only two or three houses for kilometers and kilometers. No running water, no power. But once again, the power of imagination. And I think that that's really the signature of my childhood.
Your grandmother was quite a big influence on you. You talk about various influences from your family and played, I think, a huge part in where you've ended up.
Both my grandfather and my grandmother, they were the yin and the yang. I think that they were both people who allow me to do things. My grandfather, by the way, he was my hero when I was a little boy. And why? Because he would let me do whatever I wanted to do. He allowed my brain to form new synapses and new connections. And my grandmother, she would be the one who would put boundaries. I don't think I would be who I am today without the two of them. But of course, everybody in my family, my grandfather from my mom's side, my parents themselves continued to cultivate that spirit of adventure. So yes, my grandmother was crucial. I knew this when I was a little boy. I knew this many, many years after she left this world physically, but spiritually she lives in me.
What do you think she would make of what you've done and what you've achieved?
I think that she would be very proud. She was a town healer, a midwife in the small little town where we grew up. And she decided to stay in the very poor areas of Mexico to help people because that was her passion. Her passion was not money. Her passion was to help people. And I think that she would be very proud of the fact that I continue in some ways her tradition of giving back, her tradition of helping those who have less. And I think that she would be very, very proud of that.
And the passion for what you do, how important is that in the relationship that you have with your patients too?
It is. It's crucial. I mean, I do believe that the secret to my success is partly my talent as a surgeon, my talent as a scientist, but a great part, my power to connect to them, just like my grandmother, my Nana Maria, did with her own patients. And I remember I would often be there in their house as a little boy, and I would see how people would come in, and they would give her a chicken, they would deliver some tamales, they would deliver some tortillas, they would do something because they had no ways to pay her and thank her for her saving the life of a child or taking care of them. The power of giving back to be much, much more powerful than any amount of money that anybody can ever make in the world.
Your family eventually moved to Northern California. What kind of work were you doing?
Well, you know, like many families, my roots go back to the time of the braceros. Braceros were the people who were immigrating mainly from Mexico to the United States, to different parts of the United States, California being one of the largest states, Texas being another state, Washington, the Carolinas, Chicago, anywhere where there was a fair amount of farm labor to be done. My brother and I had a small little television that we bought for like 5 pesos and we fixed it. And then I began to see that beyond my town, there was another country called the United States. And then correlating that to my uncles and my family coming back and bringing us food because we were going through a very economic depression. So that's how I ended up one day coming to the United States. The very first time I came, I was just 15 years old and I crossed the border illegally, landed in the fields and begged for a job because back home we had nothing to eat. And I cannot even imagine what it's like for my parents. As I look back, Graham, I remember I went back after the first summer of 83. I left Mexicali in the back of a pickup truck, illegally crossed the border, went into the San Joaquin Valley in California, found a job, worked for 2 months nonstop, left Mexicali at age 15. I had just saved almost $1,000 that I was hiding in my boot. And that is money that gave us food for a whole year. So that was my life as a little boy. 2 years working in the fields and I'm going to come back triumphant, make tons of money. So I never returned triumphant. I never made tons of money, but I found happiness.
It was also while you were in California that there was an incident, and this moment was a real turning point for you.
It was amazing. You're talking about April 14th, 1989. I was 21 years old, and I was working on the railroad. My father was working there. My brother-in-law was working there, a whole crew, not really knowing the danger of the work that I was doing, working with liquefied petroleum gas tankers, welding with high level of octane power. I ended up at the bottom of a giant liquefied petroleum gas tanker that was empty with gas, liquid, but fuel of the toxic, intoxicating fumes that eventually almost took my life. By the grace of God, I'm a man of faith, and I was saved by my father, my brother-in-law, and a friend of mine named Oscar, and they risked their own life. My brother-in-law went in twice. He's the one who went in because my father, they almost also brought him back dead. My brother-in-law, they almost got him out dead. It was an amazing story. I woke up in the hospital, my father crying, my brother-in-law on one side, and me not understanding what had happened. You know, I made it out of there, Graham, and I'm not going to lie to you. It had an impact in my life in such a way that it allowed me to refocus. It was trauma too, by the way. I didn't deal with it emotionally and psychologically until probably the last decade that I realized what an impact it had in who I was. Every now and then I wake up with nightmares about it because I almost died. And it also makes me feel guilty. Why did I make it out? Why have I been so blessed to be able to have this practice, to be a Mayo professor, to be a brain surgeon, and so on and so forth? There are feelings of happiness and feelings of guilty that come up, and emotions and mixed things that come up in my nightmares from time to time. When I have the opportunity to be brought back to terra firma, and it is when I finish surgeries with my patients, and I go and I tell their families what happened, and they hug me, and I feel at that moment where they're hugging me that I have my feet back on the ground, you know, and realizing that it is real, that even though it may seem like a dream, there is a reality. Now, don't take me wrong. There are a lot of tough moments. I have failed many, many more times than I have succeeded, because no matter how good of surgery I do, no matter how successful my laboratory is, at the end, I cannot defeat brain cancer. But what I can do is give my patients hope. What I can do is make them feel that they're part of a journey, that I am there with them, and I'm going to mentor them, coach them, learn from them, share with them, cry with them, smile with them, whatever, share the joy of life. Every single day, I walk into the operating room. I tell my patients, if you ever go into the OR with a surgeon that is not afraid, you better run for your life. That surgeon is going to hurt you. But it's not fear that matters, Graham. It's the way that you react to that fear. Can you use that energy, that adrenaline, to concentrate to the maximum, to feel when you are in the operating room as if you're part of a symphony, and to hear every single sound in such a way that you feel that that music is beautiful and every note fits exactly what you want to do, which is bring that patient into the OR and out of the OR alive and doing well.
What is it like to go literally inside somebody's head and to see and to touch the human brain? Describe what that's like.
I cannot describe it with words. I mean, it's the feelings, the emotions, the gratitude, the fear, the adrenaline, everything is mixed together that I just don't know if I have the intellect, the ability with my words to be able to tell you how deep and how emotional those moments are. And I'm not afraid of embracing those feelings. You know what I mean? I'm not afraid of embracing joy when there is joy, sadness when there is sadness, because I consider it a gift that I'm given by my patients every day that I can touch. Imagine the gratitude, the knowing that they trust a stranger with their life, that they put, that we're navigating that fine line between life and death in the operating room, that when the heart rate goes down, my heart rate goes up. In a moment of where things are not looking good in the brain, I feel like I lose years of my life. That when I see them waking up, I can imagine a mother seeing the birth of their baby and not remembering what it was like to go through labor. That's how I feel when I see them cutting deep. I don't think gets any deeper than what I do when I go into the brain is the soul, the unknown frontier, all right? That is something that I carry in a responsibility also that I feel. When I walk into that operating room with that patient, we are together. And I'm not alone. We are a team, Graham, a team.
So how do you cope with the stress then? I mean, how do you get relief from that pressure that you've got? I mean, obviously, you said that you deal with it, but how do you do that? I mean, in terms of maybe hobbies and things that you do away from the kind of work that you do. Tell us a little bit about how that works for you.
I love learning. I really do. I love reading. I listen to music. Like today, I already have it in my mind. I'm going to listen to a lot of music from the 80s, the top rock anthems from the 80s. I'm going to be working out. I work out exactly for an hour and a half, and then I stretch for 30 minutes, very intense workout. And then I'm going to go ahead and spend time with my family, have dinner. I'll probably watch a movie with my wife and my daughter, or I watch an episode of a Netflix show.
Do you listen to music while you're operating? Is that something you do? I know some people do, but is that something that you indulge in?
I love the music that the operating room makes. The hissing sounds, the beeps of the machine. That to me, once again, is the symphony that very few people get to recognize how beautiful it is. The beating of the monitors of someone's heart, the echo that it makes in the OR. The hemostats, when they crunch a towel, you know, if you pay attention, the microscope, when it moves, you know, the bipolar, the way, you know, these are the little devices that we have, the stimulator of the brain, the sound that it makes, all that to me is absolutely beautiful music.
What you're saying is your operating theater is your orchestra and you are the conductor. What would you say these days in the field of neurosurgery and neuroscience is still the villain of this story? What for you is something that we still need to address and we still need to sort out?
Two that come to my mind immediately is cancer. You know, it's a devastating disease. It's going to be the leading cause of death in the United States already, the leading cause of death in 21 states. That's based on a paper that I just published in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings. It is estimated that by the year 2025, it's going to be the leading cause of death in the United States, period. By the year 2030, it's estimated it's going to be the leading cause of death in the world. The problem is that cancer is extraordinarily expensive. We really haven't been able to crack the code. Cerebrovascular, cardiovascular diseases, we're doing better. Cholesterol medications, blood pressure medications, procedures that we go through, the little catheters and we put stents. It's amazing the progress that we made. That's why that disease remains stable. And cancer continues to rise and is extraordinarily expensive. How many times you hear about these medications for cancer being prohibitively expensive? So for me, cancer is a killer. We have to try to defeat it. It's a villain. The other one, which is related to cancer, is the access, inequality, inequity to care. That to me is a villain, that it has no face and has no name, but it is there with us every single day. And we have to figure out how we're going to fight it. In my own way, I feel like I'm fighting a dragon with a toothpick, but I am having a strong posture against it. And I am going to continue to do it until I cannot breathe anymore, because I'm passionate about it.
This whole series is about hope. It's about hope for patients, their families. In a way, you've already sort of answered it, but generally speaking, how do you see the future of the science we're talking about here? Are we going in the right direction?
No question about it. I got to tell you. So remember, hope is the only emotion that is more powerful than fear. It can overcome fear anytime. Hope is the only emotion that allows us to keep going, to keep dreaming, and it allows our dreams to become a reality one day because we ended up putting a lot of efforts. Our youth is beginning to form bridges. Now we're connecting students from the Mayo Clinic, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, to students in India and Latin America through this foundation where we're trying to help people. So we are communicating. These are the future generations. Our discoveries, the things, for instance, in my laboratory, we have over 28 patents that we have put, you know, two companies that I started. We are trying to figure out how do we make cancer care more accessible. For instance, one of the operating rooms that I use is a $10 million operating room. How many places in the world can do that already? But it turns out that we are inventing machines that we can create for $30,000, $50,000 that could potentially do the same amount of work by allowing us to see cancer moving in the brain, allowing us to image this cancer in the operating room, therefore making it a possibility that anywhere in the world, someone will be able to do equally complex type of brain surgery. That to me is the future. The discoveries that we're doing today, whether it is nanotechnology, nanoparticle, artificial intelligence, are going to allow us to begin to get the world better connected, better access, and hopefully our future generations will have much more equity in how they get access to this complex disease care.
How much do you feel that you play an important part in that? If you could wave a magic wand and be responsible for doing one single thing right now, basically leave a legacy, what would it be for you?
Do you know that there are more deaths a year from lack of access to surgical care than any other disease? Simple things, appendectomies, a toe infection. I mean, just so many little things that are leading to death. So I think that someone like me represents hope to saying we can actually, if this guy can go around the world and can do $500,000, $1 million surgeries and complexity on patients with little resources, why can't we do other stuff that is more accessible? So we provide hope. I think that hopefully our work is playing a role on that sort of way of thinking that we can make it better. I think that if I had a magic wand, I would like to see how we can invest more on making sure that people have access to surgical care, because that's what I'm passionate right now. But all medical care, of course, is equally important. But surgical care itself, I mean, it is absolutely devastating that we don't have places when the technology is potentially there to be able to do that in other parts of the world. But we have to empower people. This is why we empower, we treat, we exchange knowledge. It's so crucial. And I'm hoping that through this work, we'll motivate a lot of other people to keep doing even better things and teach us back how we can do it better.
Our reporter, Graham Seaman, talking to Dr. Alfredo Quiñones Hinojosa, professor and chair of neurologic surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Now, in our next episode...
I remember all my tumor patients. I can put a name and a face at everyone. So I go 500%, mind, soul, and hands, ready to help these people.
That was Dr. Claire Karakazi, Rwanda's first and only female neurosurgeon, who's making a difference for her country after studying and practicing neurosurgery around the world. Claire will be talking about why she wanted to be a neurosurgeon, how she copes with the decisions she has to make in the operating theater, the challenges her country still faces in the field of neuro-oncology, and why she even once wanted to be an astronaut. We'll also hear where she sees the future of neurosurgery for both the world and for her homeland. I'm Kathy Oliver, Chair and Co-Director of the International Brain Tumor Alliance, and you've been listening to A Brain Tumor and Me, a journey of inspiration, personal stories, and hope. If you'd like to find out more about the work we do, just go to our website, theibta.org, and thank you for listening. This has been a GS Media production for the IBTA.